Whenever you're ready, Simon.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre and television. In fact, anything that's been entertaining Steve, McCabe and I lately.
This time, a hearty mix of the aforementioned cultural delights for you. In film, we've got Marvel delivering another visual spectacle in the form this time of Doctor Strange.
Yes, Tom Cruise delivering another Tom Cruise movie.
That's what he does, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, what else can he deliver, I hear you say. In this case, it's called Jack Reacher Never Go Back, the second outing of Mr. Reacher.
Now, do you think he will go back?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A title like that, nah, bad idea, because you know he's going to go back. You can pretty much lay money on it. Now, in music, Slipknot and Lamb of God. Now, they delivered some heavy metal at Vector Arena, and I was brave enough to get down the photo pit to shoot that one for us.
Yeah, some very well-received photos on the website, I hear, Steve. Yeah,
absolutely.
Good stuff. Now, we've had a busy week or so. I've chatted to a couple of the creators and performers in the Auckland Dance Theatre Group, which calls itself Dynamotion. And they are soon to deliver a reprise, what do you say, reprise? Depends where you're born, I think, of their James Bond spoof. And that's coming up a little later this year, in December, in Auckland. We'll tell you a little bit more about that soon.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
In the meantime, should we kick off with one that is already available? Well, let's take a trip to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
Which has delivered mixed offerings so far this year, in my opinion. But last week we saw Doctor Strange. Now, Simon, you, if I remember correctly, smiled at the end of this.
You have an excellent memory. I lapped this one up, I have to say. I have to confess up front, Steve, we've discussed this before, I'm generally predisposed to these Marvel films. But you're right, some have been more successful than others. I think this one, Doctor Strange, is actually right up there with the best of them so far. In fact, any fantasy adventure movie. The visuals are outstanding, but you've also got a really, really good cast. The script is a cracking one. And as probably, I think, the most important thing with any of these sort of superhero-type movies, whoever makes them, that this time Doctor Strange has a nice balance between the action and the humour. And so the tone is good. For what is actually, Steve, when you think about it, yet another origin movie?
It was an origin movie. I mean, basically, it's pretty clearly set up that this is going to be, in the greatest tradition of origins films, it is setting the seed, sowing the seed. We set the stage, we sow the seed. It's sowing the stage for a whole sequence of future Doctor Strange films, and I don't know that would be a bad thing.
No. So let's quickly go over what's going on in the story without giving too much away.
Yeah, there is something with story, isn't there?
Yeah.
So we've got Benedict Cumberbatch acting against type and with type, curiously, both at the same time.
As
Dr. Stephen Strange. He's a brilliant but rather arrogant and egotistical brain surgeon. Now, there's a character we've never seen before, so we obviously found a lot of new material there. We meet his former girlfriend, fellow doctor, fellow surgeon, Christine Palmer, played gamely by a totally underused Rachel McAdams.
That would be fair.
She's really not given a whole lot to do. She does what she's needed to do, but that's not a whole lot. She's somewhat in despair of his lack of empathy and humanity. But then a really quite dramatic car crash.
Yeah, then some. Yeah, you're right.
With clearly a message deep within, as he signalled at the end of the credits, if you remember, a rather dramatic car crash destroys almost his hands.
Yep.
And so he finds himself, through a bizarre twist of circumstances and embroiled in his bitter resentment, he finds himself off in Nepal.
That's right. As you do.
Where else would you go? Yeah. looking for a place called Kamataj.
Yes.
Which I thought sounded like a slightly questionable Luxembourgian wine blend. Which is... I'm sure we've got another bottle of the Kamataj. Yes, why don't we? There's a clunky name for...
Now that you say that, yes.
Yeah, exactly. A clunky name for this little hermitage-type place he's looking for. And he finally hooks up with the Ancient One, who is played absolutely beautifully by the incomparable Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, and doesn't look so ancient, let it be said.
No, not at all. But, I mean, she can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. She's quite a remarkable actor. And so he then does the traditional neophyte being trained in the mystical ways routine that we've seen how many times before, and yet, I don't know, what do you reckon?
They did it well. I think, yeah, I mean, it's you're right. It's this tutelage. It's mystic arts, but it could be martial arts. It could be all sorts of things, couldn't it, Steve? But, yeah, and as part of all this, we won't now get into too much of the later parts of the plot to spoil it for you, but he meets a whole bunch of other characters played by also some very good actors, Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Well done, by the way. Full marks on at least having a swing at that one.
Thank you. And Benedict Wong, who plays a character called Wong.
Yes.
Interestingly enough. Stephen Strange, basically, he ends up aiming to become a master of the mystic arts. And there's a supreme enemy that he will almost inevitably have to face at some point in the story. So, I mean, I think there's probably enough of the story to give you an idea of what's going on. I just want to reinforce what you said about Tilda Swinton, Steve. It was almost, well, she kind of underplayed it, but it's just with a lovely touch. It was almost like here's this apparently supreme mystical master of all sorcery, and she's chatting in such a matter-of-fact, offhand way. It belies what the character's all about. It's really, really lovely performance.
Well, one thing that struck me, I'm going to be very, very parochial here and very, very English, but this is the first that I can think of anyway, the first Marvel Comic Universe film, which is basically a British film. It's set in New York initially. Cumberbatch plays an American, and he plays, you know, he does the accent reasonably convincingly. But you've got Cumberbatch, you've got Swinton, you've got Wong, you've got Ejiofor, all English.
Yep.
And so what you've got here is people who can act. They might look, they look the part with it. They look fantastic along. But underpinning everything is they're not movie stars. They're not simply people who got the job because they got the amazing cheekbones, although they do, to be fair. They got the job because they can act.
You're absolutely right. I agree.
And you see this, I think, more clear than anywhere else in some of the earlier scenes where Strange meets the Ancient One for the first time. And he's begging and pleading, and he's clearly on the back foot for the first time in his entire life, presumably. And yep. And she bats him around like a kitten with a ball of wool. And in other hands, this would have been a clunky, cumbersome, overwrought piece of dialogue. Those two, you can tell they're having fun with it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. I think there's quite a classiness to the way this is all done. And actually, just want to mention one thing, Steve, because you talked about the new character of Stephen Strange. Of course, he is new to the cinematic universe. You're quite right. But just reading on this guy, the character, actually goes back to 1963. He was one of the characters who was written about, created way back when Spider-Man and the X-Men and all that were going on. He hasn't in the comic book world been as popular as some of the other ones, but I think probably Marvel have done a fantastic job of breathing new life into him. And he could, I thought the way Benedict Cumberbatch played him, he could even become a sort of character to rival Tony Stark in the future.
Well, he's being compared to a degree with Tony Stark, and one comment I have heard made, I'm not going to take credit for this one, although I wish I could, but one thing that people are pointing out is that I guess kind of similar to Stark, he kind of had to earn his status in the universe. He wasn't just bitten by a radioactive spider or whatever it might be. He actually had to work at it, and that just slightly set the character apart from other Marvels, other Avengers, yep. Let's say. He wasn't descended from Asgard, for example.
No, he
and you see him struggling, you see him not becoming powerful, you see him having to do the whole tutelage thing, and I think that makes the character a little bit more accessible, plus Benedict Cumberbatch, obviously.
Yes. We must mention, and you and I were lucky enough to go not only to see this in 3D, but to see it on a big IMAX screen. We must mention the visuals because, I mean, that's one of the big draw cards of this film. I mean,
weren't we fortunate to see it the only way it can really, really be appreciated?
I know. I was thinking that afterwards. I thought, I wouldn't mind seeing this again. But then I also, at the same time, thought, if I was going to see it again, I'd have to go back and see it in the IMAX because I'm spoilt now.
Yes.
Yeah.
The visuals are stunning. I mean, it's an amazing film to look at, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I have to say, just coming into the film, Steve, I'd seen at least one of the trailers where there was a sequence showing a fascinating, moving urban landscape, which immediately brought to mind a film by another British filmmaker, Christopher Nolan, who did Inception.
Oh, and, very, very definitely. It's one, yeah, of the, one of the, like, the calling cards of Inception, really, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And so I thought, oh no, is this going to feel too much like that? Well, by the time we got to that, I was already so dazzled by all the other special effects. It didn't seem to matter so much to me, although I think it is a bit of a steal, but it doesn't, in the long run, I don't think it matters.
No, I have to be honest, that while I was watching the film, I was completely caught up in it. Afterwards, when I was trying to compose my thoughts about it, it occurred to me that there's a degree to which it almost becomes gratuitous.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
But having said that, though, it looks phenomenal.
No, it really, really is amazing. And if you can see it in 3D, it's really worth paying a few dollars extra to do so.
Oh, most assuredly. There's also, in some of the sequences, I don't know if you picked up on this, but there's slight echoes of The Matrix.
Yeah, I think that's, yes, I think so.
Even even down to the Ancient One asking him, what if I told you? which is straight out of The Matrix, obviously.
Well, they're having quite a bit of fun with this film, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's probably the one thing that's been missing from every other Marvel film, with the possible exception of Deadpool, is there is fun. You can tell that and again, I think this is the fact that you've got quality actors who know how to work their lines. They are able to sort of step in and out of the lightness and the humour of the lines that they're offering. I mean, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, but there's one wonderful exchange where the baddie, played by Mads Mikkelsen, keeps getting Doctor Strange's title wrong.
Oh, yeah, yes. And
they manage to play it for laughs without descending into farce.
Yes, they do. I'm going to take some issue with you about that sweeping statement you just made about Marvel movies lacking fun. I think it definitely applies to some of them, but I thought the first Avengers movie had a good sense of fun. And at least one of the Iron Man films did. So, because I think Robert Downey Jr., get that out, has the ability to do that. But anyway, that's a little aside there.
Yeah, okay. I can allow it up to a point, but generally speaking, I've not seen any of them yet that have had quite this range in them. They all tend to be a little bit one note. This did manage to roam around the various moods effortlessly.
Yeah, I think one thing I would say about this, Steve. Even someone who isn't into superhero movies at all.
Well, that would be me.
And I know a few.
Yeah.
You could take them to this film, and I think they'd enjoy it because of the quality of the acting, the humor in the script, and the fantastic visuals. The fact that it's a superhero type movie doesn't really matter in the end. It's just a quality piece of entertainment.
Of course it is. I mean, in the end, I mean, there's all the nonsense about the various dimensions. It's clearly complete not a twaddle, but then, you know, superhero stuff. But the nice thing about this film I found was there's so much else going on. There's character development. There's witty dialogue. There's so much else going on that you're willing to forgive, and you just overlook that. You say, okay, fine, I've bought into it, I'm enjoying it, just do what you need to do, boys, and you have fun with it.
Yeah,
I like that aspect of it.
Me too. Well, we're both pretty positive about this one.
There is one criticism I have to make, though.
Okay, go on.
Now, it did, toward the end, start to descend a little bit, as my friend Eric, who came to see the film with us, commented. It did descend a little bit into Harry Potter for grown-ups territory.
Yes, I suppose if you're doing a story about a magician or a sorcerer, that's going to be hard to avoid. But yeah, maybe that's fair. Yeah,
But in particular, when the floating cloak wraps itself around Doctor Strange, and he that transforms him pretty much into the superhero that he's becoming, as opposed to the mere mortal that once he were. And all I could see is he's suddenly wearing this high collared cloak. He's now got a very, very questionable goatee. And, yes. And the cheekbones look like they've been polished and sharpened. And all I could see was Emperor Ming from the Flash Gordon films.
Is that right? Okay, that's interesting.
He was definitely Ming the Merciless at that point.
Ming the Merciless. Oh, all these cultural parallels we can draw. Hey, so... the other thing is, if you are watching and you are a fan of these films, as usual with the Marvel film, stick around for all the end credit sequences, because there are always a few little extra scenes they throw in just to keep you interested. So that's,
definitely, yes.
Yeah.
And Simon, did you happen to notice the Spike Lee cameo?
No. Spike Lee? No, I didn't.
I'll tell you after we finish recording.
Okay. Please do. I can't wait.
Yeah.
All right, so Doctor Strange, a pretty resounding tick from both of us, I think.
Oh, I would recommend not only buy a ticket, but buy a ticket on the biggest screen you can find.
Now, I think, Steve, even before Marvel Studios started cranking up all its movies, one Tom Cruise was probably already a big star. So my question to you is that stardom diminished somewhat, or is he in as good a shape as he ever is after this new film, which is called Jack Reacher Never Go Back? What say you?
Well, first of all, I'd say he might be a star. He's never been big.
Well, are you talking about a stature or what?
Well, I mean, you and I can get away with saying things like that, I think, to be honest. He might be standing between us. We'd never notice.
I'm sorry.
Look, there's one fundamental problem I have with Tom Cruise. I used to live in Clearwater in Florida.
Yes.
And I am quite familiar with a certain organisation to which he belongs, and I'm not overly impressed with them. And unfortunately, right, every time I see either his name or John Travolta's name, I kind of break out into a bit of a cold sweat. The problem is, though, I mean, again, I took my friend Neil to see this one, and Neil did remark to me before we started, he said, just try and forget that it's Tom Cruise.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. And could you do that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, let's face it, who did he play in this film?
He played Tom Cruise.
Thank you. So in that regard, yeah, you can try. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do, is it? But, I mean, let's see. Never Go Back. What's the story, basically? He's Jack Reacher, isn't he? He's this wandering, I guess, you know, if this were a Japanese film, he'd be a ronin, wouldn't he? He'd be a masterless samurai.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a former military...
Operative.
Now he's almost like a roaming, problem-solving detective type who has to bail out a former colleague who has been set up in some conspiracy. He's going to get to the bottom of it. And along the way, he discovers or is at least confronted with an opportunity to discover his more human, softer side, which I understand from the books, Steve, the Jack Reacher character is anything but. He's a hard-nosed, hard-bitten, rather misogynistic sort of a character. So this film starts to maybe loosen that a little bit.
It tries very hard. I mean, the reality is that the film trades on his goodwill very, very much. He's an agreeable screen presence. He's got a certain amount of boyish charm even to this day. I mean, it's thin. There's not enough a brilliant story to it. A lot of stuff you just have to go. Like, I mean, the opening scene, which features him about to get arrested for beating up a bunch of fellas in a diner. We have no idea what's going on in that scene, why he's beating them up, why he had to do this. Something very briefly mentioned. Next thing we see is a sheriff being marched out in handcuffs. We've got no idea why, and that idea is promptly tossed away. We don't know what that was all about. Next thing you know, he's then flirting on the phone with Major Turner, played by Kobe Smulders, who's not, who you describe as a colleague, but he's not met her before, as far as we can tell.
No, you're right, you're right. Yes, she's a military, but they haven't actually met. You're quite right.
And,
yes.
And as he's sort of greyhounding in toward Washington, he's flirting with her on the phone. You just have to. It's like I said with Doctor Strange. You kind of have to make a pact with yourself. I'm going to overlook the nonsense. I'm just going to go with it. But in Doctor Strange, that was effortless. There was so much else that you could choose to buy into that you didn't have to dwell on the nonsense. But this one, I struggled.
Yeah, I think I also, as I was watching it, was confronted with that same question. Yeah, can you sit back and enjoy the ride? But actually, although he's meant to be almost like a super detective, some of the way the dots are connected and the way he gets to a certain place to find a certain person or to know a certain thing, it's happened, and you think, how the heck did that? What just happened there? How did they put those two things together? How did he figure that out? And I found that rather distracting from time to time, I have to say. But I agree that he is a guy who knows, like that famous Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry movie, a man's got to know his limitations. I think he knows his craft really well.
Yeah.
I think he knows what he can and can't do and who his audience are and what they like. And there are certain things that you kind of see in his movies where he does as many of his own stunts as he can. He stays very fit and strong. You see him running. You see him doing a lot of physical stuff, a little bit of humor. Not much romance in this film, at least not overt romance. So he's, you know, those sort of touchstones are there, aren't they?
Yes.
I used the word agreeable, didn't you, Steve?
I think that's a
fair word. You know, it's not awful by any means. It's if you're into sort of a bit of an action thriller, you'll probably quite enjoy it. But it's a Tom Cruise movie, for good or for ill. That's what it is.
It is, and Cobie Smulders does her best. And were you ever a fan of How I Met Your Mother? The American sitcom.
I'm just trying. I actually have not been a watcher of that, so you have got one over me.
Well, this was, as far as I'm aware, it's where she first really came to fame, and it's one of my favourite sitcom series ever. 8 series of very tightly, sharply observed comedy, and she's very good in it, and part of that is the fact that she's surrounded by very, very talented comic actors, and she's also given brilliant scripts and fantastic stories to work with. And so when she played Robin Scherbatsky in How I Met Your Mother, and in particular, if you've never seen her alter ego Robin Sparkles in How I Met Your Mother, you really need to go and check out the video for the Beaver song. It's an eye-opener, it really is. In that, she's fantastic fun. But she needs all that support around her, and she needs the right roles. And quite frankly, Major Turner isn't the right role for her. She clearly is. I mean, we're aware of her limitations at the end of this film.
Okay.
Now, to be fair, part of that is the nonsense that she's given. So, she at one point is on the run in the middle of DC.
Yes.
She's a soldier. She's a major in the army, in the military police to be exact, and she's on the run. And she's running through the streets of DC in her combat fatigues.
Yes, I saw that too, and I thought, what's going on there?
And you're thinking, okay, well, that obviously she's going to have to do something about this and change her outfit. So what she does is she takes off her camouflage jacket and she gets a baseball cap from a taxi driver. So then you've got her running through the streets of DC in camouflage trousers, a khaki T-shirt, and a blue baseball cap. And you're thinking, there you go, that's it. She's completely blending in now. It is preposterous.
Yeah. Hey, we should just mention quickly, there is one other major character in this film, a young actor or actress called Danica Yarosh.
Who plays a
teenage age youngster who may or may not have an important connection to Jack Reacher. She was also agreeable and did a pretty good job. I did wonder at the end, I thought it got a little bit syrupy and over schmaltzy at the very end there when certain decisions are having to be made about the future. And I wonder also, and I have to find a really avid reader of the Jack Reacher books to tell me whether the way the story ended sat well with someone who knows what Jack Reacher's really all about.
Yes.
Maybe because it's Tom Cruise, maybe we don't worry about that anymore. I'm not sure.
I think you're doing her a disservice. I would say she was the best thing in the film.
Ah, okay.
She started off a little bit the angsty teenager and not much else. I thought she brought more depth to her character than Cruise or Smulders did.
Well, she was the injection of something fresh into the whole storyline, wasn't she?
To
shake it all up. So yeah, I think that's fair comment. That's fair comment. Anyway, I don't think we've seen the last of Tom Cruise. You know.
No, they are going to go back, aren't they?
Yeah, and I saw something the other day, Steve. There's a sixth Mission Impossible film being worked up at the moment. So he's not quitting yet, not by a long way. He'll be back.
Yeah, because I'm sure he needs the money.
Yeah. So I don't. I was just thinking about your Scientology comment. You didn't use that word, but I just have. And I just did a bit of reading, and just to remind myself that for all the stuff he cops and quite fairly about that, he has actually had three Oscar nominations for acting, and he's actually won three Golden Globes for acting. So somewhere, sometimes, some people like what he does.
Well, as the old saying goes, even a stopped clock is right twice a day.
But
let's be honest. I mean, he has basically played himself in Top Gun, in The Color of Money, in Cocktail, in Days of Thunder, you name it, in Mission Impossible, in Jerry Maguire. When has he played anybody but himself?
Now, I'm just trying to remember, and I haven't got a great memory of it, that one film where he played the bad guy, Collateral. Did you see that one?
No, that one I didn't. No. Maybe I missed the one film that I should have seen then.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's still Tom Cruise, but he's definitely the bad guy in that film. And maybe it's worth us on a rainy afternoon checking that out just to see. Anyway, maybe it isn't worth
it. Does he deserve redemption? We'll take that under advisement.
Yes. So I think we're both feeling slightly mixed about this one. I wouldn't say to someone, definitely don't see it. If you're into this type of if you're after something but diverting, that's not going to tax you too much, except the plot doesn't make a lot of sense. But apart from that, you're probably going to enjoy it. But it's not a top grade, top quality thriller. I wouldn't say that at all.
No, not at all. I mean, if you're going to buy a ticket, wait till a Tuesday afternoon when the tickets are half price.
Ooh, okay, that's fair enough. I won't disagree with that. Shall we just take a slight breather from the epics on screen to discuss your recent escapade into the world of heavy metal music?
Yes,
tell me about that. Yes, please do.
I have never really been a huge fan of the extreme end of heavy metal, and do remember one of my first concerts as a teenager was Iron Maiden. I like my guitars loud and my drums pounding. But Slipknot usually would be not the music I'd be seeking out, to be perfectly honest. And the music itself is not my thing. I'm trying to be as fair as possible. If I were being less charitable, I'd say it's complete and absolute rubbish. It is pounding drums, and it is screaming guitars, and it's even loudlier screaming singers. But I'll tell you what, go and see them live. It's a hell of a performance. And so I did. They played Auckland's Vectra Arena last week. They were supported by Lamb of God, who were as noisy and as nothing else as I imagined they would be, and that was all very well and good. And I was awfully glad of my hearing protectors in the photo pit. But when Slipknot came on, I was aware it was going to be somewhat theatrical. I had no idea quite how good it was going to be. Let's just count that you've got drummer, keyboard player, DJ, you've got two front drummers, you've got two guitarists, a bass player and a singer. So it's a big band in matching grey boiler suits and terrifying masks.
Oh, I see.
Not a single face on display. The band members officially don't have names, they have numbers.
Right.
And so you'll see, for example, the word 7 tattooed at the guitarist's arm. We shan't give away names just to buy into the whole thing. And as a piece of musical theatre, it's hard to beat. Now,
that's quite a visual thing as much as an audio experience.
Very, very much so. You've got two. They're referred to as custom percussionists, two drummers. Apparently, they're known to their fans as Clown and Big Nose, who are on massive risers at the front of the stage. You don't put your drummers at the front, but they do. And it works. It works remarkably well. The music, I couldn't even tell you what the music sounded like. I had hearing protectors in. Oh, dear God, I needed them. There were, in addition to the usual massive PA stacks, there were huge loudspeakers lined up in front of the photo pit. I've never felt music as loud as this before. Wow. It was ferocious. But as a visual spectacle, you couldn't beat it. I was very, very glad I was there. Other photographers who I spoke to afterwards who were at the same show, they stayed for the whole show. And one or two of them were saying the concert of the year so far.
Wow, okay.
I would certainly say it was the I was there event of the year so far.
Actually, Steve, while you've been talking, I've just quickly gone onto our Crave website.
Ah, yes.
And had a look at the selection of photos you've put there. And just to remind myself, yeah, these are not guys, those masks are not the sort of thing you'd like to be confronted with on a dark corner on an alleyway somewhere, would you? I mean, they look almost like some of the orcs from Mordor or something like that. Wow.
It is an appropriate gallery to be looking at directly before Halloween.
Yes. Whew. Okay. Well, so if they came back and you weren't doing this for some as a photographer, would you actually go see them again just to actually see the show?
Do you know, I honestly don't know. I really can't answer that question. Mm. I have a feeling I saw enough. I'm not a fan of the music. I don't know I'd want to sit through an hour and a half of it. If you like the music, you will be blown away by the performance. But the music, you can't hear the words. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. Okay. So Slipknot and Lamb of God. Do go to our website, cravepodcast.com. And Steve's got a great selection of photos, and you'll see exactly what he's talking about with the masks and the outfits. It looks really good.
So, okay. For a change of pace, for something a little bit more accessible on stage, should we go to the theatre? The theatre.
Yes. The theatre. And in this case, it's the dance theatre. And by that, this is something a little bit different, I suppose. This last week, I caught up with a couple of the founding members, and they're also performers of an Auckland group who call themselves Dyna Motion.
Oh, yeah?
Now, they've been around since 2012. They've done a few shows. They in August this year, they had a spoof of James Bond show called Mia Blonde Ice Dagger.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a mouthful for a title, but there you are. It's going to be returning to the Q Loft Theatre in Auckland's Queen Street in December, from the 13th to the 17th of December. And so I chatted to, two of the founders, Thomas Sainsbury and Lara Liu.
This is an interview where the interviewer, like me, has to come clean right from the start and say I have not sampled the delights of Dyna Motion. So, shame on me.
Yeah.
But Thomas Sainsbury, start with you.
Yes.
What am I missing out on?
Missing out on non-dancers and some dancers, just having a good time on stage, dancing synchronized to pop music, well, to a range of music. Yeah.
With a story.
With a narrative story to it.
And Lara Liu is also with us on the podcast. Lara, when you say with a story, does that mean there is... The music stops sometimes and there is there are speeches, there's dialogue, or is it just a non-stop music all the way through?
The music does stop. Our previous shows, we've used little pieces of voiceover. Shows...
narration to carry the story along. So the dancing kind of tells the story, but sometimes you need a few extra things just to make it clear to the audience.
Yeah. Because we wanted the stories to always be accessible, so we tell as much as we can through the dance or the movement and the songs, and then the voiceovers became a little necessity for pushing story along or explaining some things that are really difficult to explain.
So if you're someone who's been to a traditional musical, I don't know, Cats or something, are you in for a very different experience on stage?
It's more a danceical than a musical, so it's all, there's no singing or anything, but it's all, the story is all told through dance. So dance makes up like 90% of the whole play.
Yeah.
Wow.
And dancer.
Yeah, exactly. And
so you're dancing the story.
We're dancing the story. And with our latest show, Mia Blonde, we tried a slightly different idea with the voiceover in that we actually pre-recorded scenes. So there are pieces of dialogue, but all of it is pre-recorded. So the actors or the dancers, dactors is what we call them.
Good name, dactors, dance actors, dactors.
It's this little term that we've coined, and it's like kind of taken off like wildfire. So anyway, the dactors
lip sync it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah.
Which is kind of just adds to the comedy and the ridiculousness of it. And the whole, our whole kind of shtick is that each of our shows is based on a movie genre. So it kind of helps with that kind of, it's so weird because what we're doing is we're taking filmic ideas because they're theatrical and making a dance show out of them.
So our latest one, Mia Blonde, is a pastiche or of James Bond films, but with a female protagonist. So we're switching all the genders around. So the Bond girls are now Bond boys and the main villains
nice
are
touch.
Female.
Yeah.
And so the, I mean, when you watch a James Bond film, especially the earlier ones, there's so much kind of dubbing that it looks like the people are lip-syncing anyway, so it kind of fits in with what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the whole, this is interesting to write something in dance. It's kind of interesting, I'm trying to get my head around that. How do you approach the, because you are both creators and founders of Dynamotion. Tom, how do you actually set out to write a story like this?
Well, we come up with all the scenes, or the so we plot out the story, and then we choose songs that kind of fit in with the tone of the scene, and then we choreograph the movements to kind of express what's happening in the scene. So we start with the plot, then we choose the music, and then we choose the actions to tell the story.
And are you, because people will be very, very familiar with some of the well-known Bond music over the years. Are you actually using Bond music in it, or not other songs?
Well, actually, for Mia Blonde, our playlist is it's largely 60s inspired, but we do have, you know, some current bangers in there as well. But what we've done, which is one of the really great things about this latest show, is Tom and our friend Jason Smith, who does a little bit of music for us and composing for our, we write some original songs. But so Tom and Jason put together this Bond theme Ice Dagger song. The actual title of the show is Mia Blonde in Ice Dagger, which is a really clunky title, but we needed to introduce this idea of Mia Blonde as James Bond, and then Ice Dagger is the story. So we've got this Ice Dagger song.
And it's been inspired by like Goldfinger or something like that, the theme tunes.
So it has all the kind of classic, those classic elements that...
I'm just interested in why you thought this was an interesting way of tackling theatre. What had you both done before that would lead you to think, oh, Dynamotion, that's it, that's where we've got to go? Tom?
Well, we'd both worked on just traditional theatre shows before, together as well, but we both enjoyed dance a lot, and so it was that was our collective point of difference, I reckon.
And I, around the time that the idea kind of jumped to the forefront of our brains was, I was doing a bunch of burlesque at that time and had kind of recently sort of branched out on my own to do that, and was dancing with this rock band as part of the band. And so each time me and another girl were doing it, each time we did a gig, we had a different sort of concept for our costumes and part of our performance and stuff. And I'd been sort of thinking about pushing that further. And when Tom and I got together to talk about like making a dance show, it evolved even kind of further than that because of, I guess, Tom's like playwright sensibilities as well. And so I guess that put together with this kind of, because I kind of realized quite quickly that part of the burlesque that I liked had a kind of a dark comedy to it. And so I guess putting those two elements together, that's how
does this have a darker comic aspect to it, or it sounds like a very spoofy sort of thing to take on Bond.
It is pretty spoofy, and the dark, like if you were to do it in a straight play, it would be dark comedy, but because you're dancing these things, it, even if you do horrible subject matter, it just always comes off. It never is dark comedy, I don't think.
No, I mean, One of our previous shows, Terror Highway. So we sort of did three Terror shows. We call it the Terror Trilogy. They're unrelated in story, but in title, they're related. Terror Island, Terror Planet, and Terror Highway. And so, for instance, in Terror Island, it was based on 70s kind of B-grade horror, and it was like this...
Survivalist horror, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like a billionaire hunting humans on a remote island for sport. And then, say, Terror Highway...
Which is dark subject matter, but it's ridiculous.
Totally dark, but in a light... sort of given a light treatment.
Yeah.
And there was shark deaths and all sorts of stuff in that. And then Terror Highway, the lead character dies and goes to hell and dances off with Satan and eventually rules Satan at the end of the show. So it's not like a cheery...
And Terror Planet, Jesus comes down at the end because it's basically they're in the humans and robots kind of interbreed, and Jesus comes down and just kills everyone just to start again. So that's quite dark as well.
Uh-huh. Sounds like it. When you say it like that, it does sound like it. Yeah.
But then all of the treatment of it is to pop songs and, I mean, and some classical music and whatnot as well for, like, dramatic effect. But, so I guess you wouldn't necessarily class it, like Tom says, as dark.
Yeah. So you guys have been around since 2012, I think it is, when you first got going.
That's
and you've got a few productions under your belt now. What's your sense of, first of all, who your audience is for this and what are the opportunities to grow that? What's the appeal out there for something, a show like this, do you think?
I think the appeal is lots of people like dancing, and this is a kind of way of seeing themselves on stage, would you say?
Yeah. I like to think of us sometimes as the everyman's dance crew because you looking at the lineup, you can literally identify pretty much
who you would be.
And there's different skill levels and different bodies and different faces. And
Oh, cool. I just want to come in there. So I was assuming that all the performers are young, fit, supple, energetic, and are brilliant dancers. Is that not necessarily what you're looking for?
No, we're all energetic.
No. Yeah, sorry, I don't mean it in a nasty way. I just mean...
No.
Sorry.
I know what I mean. I didn't take
some
it
of us
nasty.
Aren't supple.
Some, we're not all supple, we're not all...
there are a few trained dancers, but the majority are just actors who like dancing.
Yeah, and even the trained dancers are dancers who are also actors. So I don't know that... might be wrong, but I think having that actor's sensibility certainly helps because you can
tell the story through facials and things like that,
which
sometimes you don't get with dance.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. The other thing I really was interested in getting your opinion on was the place of any live theatre, but especially your theatre, Dynamotion, in this. In the cultural landscape at a time when young people especially, it seems, are so into digital entertainment, instant entertainment, instant sharing of ideas on the internet or wherever, social media. Do you feel that this type of entertainment is still rock solid?
I think theatre's been dying since it was created. Like, there's always been, theatre's always been on the way out. Like, there's always been something better to take to... have instead of theatre, and theatre just keeps going. So I think there is a need for the shared human experience.
And in a way, the Dynamotion idea, like, it's a really, like, there's a really tangible kind of joy, and that's amongst the performers, but amongst the audience as well. And I think that that's really addictive. It is for us, it's why we're still doing it, but I think that's also why people keep coming to see us. And in a way, like, we didn't start it with an idea that 4 years or 5 years, 10 years down the track we'd still be doing it. We just did it because we thought it would be fun. And then kind of went, fuck, oh, sorry. Sort of went, what have we done? What have we made? What if it's not funny? And then...
Well, the proof's in the pudding, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And people did love it, and we loved it, and so we've kept making more. And so in that sense, I feel like the idea of it is solid.
It's just being right in front of a real person, isn't it? And responding to what's in front of you on the stage. I guess that's magic.
Absolutely. And there's also, I think, people want to be... Even if you're not... If someone's watched it on opening night, other people want to be part... have that experience or to be part of the crowd, I think. And so people come because other people have talked about it. Yeah. I think that's what theatre is.
And also people come again because they want to experience it with their friend who they've bought for the first time. They want to kind of experience it for the first time again through that other person, which is quite lovely. And so we're kind of lucky in that. Like Tom says, theatre is always kind of dying, but so far we're kind of riding the uphill crest.
Sounds good.
For a time, and then we'll see what happens.
Okay, cool. Hey, just one more thing before we end. You better tell us, please, who your characters are that you play. Lara, who are you in the production?
I play a couple, but my main character
she
is
the Ice Dagger.
I'm a hell of a bitch, which is...
Sorry?
My character is I'm a hell of a bitch.
I'm a hell of a bitch, okay.
She's a Belarusian figure skater, wronged figure skater. She's sort of disgraced, rather. She's intent on winning gold at the Winter Olympics, and if she doesn't, she wants to destroy the world.
And who can blame her?
Yeah.
And Tom, what about you?
I play Phil McCracken.
That's a rather humdrum name.
Yeah, it is. He's a Scotsman
It's like another agent.
Yeah, he's a double. Well, he's got his own agenda, but he kind of teams up with Mia Blonde, and they kind of travel together.
Look, it sounds like incredible fun. I will go and see it in December, and I look forward to doing another review for our podcast. Thank you for talking to the Crave podcast today, Lara and Thomas.
Thank you very much.
So that's Lara Liu and Thomas Sainsbury from Dynamotion. And apologies if the sound is a little bit echoey. We were talking in the quietest spot we could find at the back of a cafe. And sometimes we don't always get the most amenable circumstances to record interviews, but never mind, there might have been the clink of an odd coffee cup or something. But the show again, it's called Mia Blonde Ice Dagger. Sounds like a lot of fun. It'll be on at the Q Loft Theatre in Auckland's Queen Street from December the 13th to the 17th. You can actually book for it already. We'll put a link on our Crave website. We will do that, won't we? Yes, we will.
Absolutely.
And I think I'll definitely go and see it. Sounds like a lot of fun.
It does sound quite brilliant. I mean, there have been James Bond spoofs over the years. Some have worked, some have failed.
Yes, and I think the thing about this, as they were explaining there, Steve, the idea of constructing a whole story with dance and song being the principal way to drive the story along, there's apparently a little bit of voiceover here and there, but effectively you're going to see a dance show. So... I'm not sure how many James Bond spoofs there've been to dance, but this is one of them, so it should be good.
We shall look forward to that.
Yeah, what else, actually, speaking of that, what else is ticking along over the next week or two or three?
Well, let's see. There's been a few interesting announcements just recently. Let's have a look what we've got coming up. Faulty Towers, the stage show.
I've seen Mr. Cleese himself advertising that on television.
Yes, and this is the official, authorised version of Faulty Towers live. So the script is written by Cleese himself, and he's selected the cast. He's not in it, but he's obviously the creative urge behind it. And that's going to be at the Bruce Mason Centre up in Takapuna in Auckland, starting on February the 3rd of next year. Then they're going down to the Isaac Theatre Royal Company, the Isaac Theatre Royal in Christchurch from the 21st of February, and then back up to Wellington at the St James Theatre from March the 7th. I've been trying to find out how this jibes with the dinner theatre show of Faulty Towers with a U, not a W, that Cleese apparently is trying to start legal action against in New Zealand.
Ah, okay.
So I know they play in the Auckland area quite a bit, and I'm actually hoping to see them at some point before the Cleese show arrives. Mm. But I have to say, I mean, I am a massive, massive fan, as is anybody of my age from England.
Yes.
I can recite entire episodes from memory. You don't want me to, trust me. Don't get me started, or I will, and I'll have to edit the entire thing out. But I grew up with this.
Yeah, I think many of us do. I think in New Zealand it was very, very popular as well, and it's still. I mean, I think the fact they only did as few episodes as they did somehow has cemented the uniqueness of it. And I don't know. I was just, while you were talking, Steve, trying to think of the one scene that I think I know there's many scenes that would stick in your mind. I always loved the one where he gets so mad at his car, he goes away, gets a branch, and comes back and starts thrashing his car.
That's it! I've warned you! They give you a damn good thrashing! Yes, I'm very, very familiar with it. I can picture it now, and I laugh every time I see it, even thinking about it. So yeah, I mean, how this will translate to the stage remains to be seen, but with Cleese as the, as I say, the creative heart of it, I don't know how you can go far wrong.
No.
So we've got that coming up in February.
Yes.
The Basement Theatre are doing their annual Christmas show, the opening night before Christmas.
Right.
That's coming up very shortly at, obviously, the Basement Theatre in Auckland. Obviously, you know, we are a very, very Auckland-centric production here. But this is going to be the 6th and the 22nd. Okay. They're doing the same thing. They're having the different guest star every night. Okay, yes. A rotating guest star list is coming up. What else have we got coming up? We've got James Taylor.
Oh, yes. I saw you. Goodness.
He's coming to New Zealand for the first time in 7 years.
He must be in his 70s now, wouldn't he be?
He's not young. I don't have a date to hand, unfortunately. But what I can tell you is February the 4th, Vector Arena. Yeah. He's doing Napier. That's his other Kiwi date. Napier Church Road Winery is going to be the following day, Sunday, February the 5th.
Okay. He was born in 19... Just doing a quick Google. He was born in 1948, so he's 68. So he's not quite 70, but he's still quite getting to the venerable stage.
Venerability has been bestowed, definitely, yes.
Yeah.
Speaking of venerable, we've also got Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Oh, yes, and you've got note of that on our website. That's excellent, yep.
All these are on the website, all these. I mean, they're doing, unsurprisingly, an extensive Australian show, but also they're doing January the 17th, they're in Wellington, Wednesday the 18th, they're up here in Auckland.
Yeah, very good. And just in the movies, actually, it's something else you've put in the website, Steve, about Ben Harper. You mentioned him the other day, but he's extended his tour. He's going down to Hawke's Bay as well.
Well,
change of venue.
They were always playing Hawke's Bay on December the 3rd, but they changed venues.
That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, originally meant to have been at the Mission Estate Winery down in Hawke's Bay, and they've now changed it to Church Road Winery, which is where James Taylor's playing as well.
Gotcha.
If you have tickets, if anyone happens to be listening that has tickets for that one, they remain valid. It's just show up.
Good. Okay. And just on the movies, there are a few coming up in the next little while. Another, what appears to be an attempt to do a serious science fiction film. It's called Arrival.
Yes.
We might have an opportunity to see that in the next week or two. Ben Affleck, yet again, trying to show he's a top-notch movie star. He's got another one called The Accountant, which is about to kick off in the very next few days, I believe.
Yes.
I'm not sure about him, but anyway, we might have a view on that at some point. There's a thought. I think it's just come out. It sounds, on one hand, extremely serious and perhaps somber, but it's from that acclaimed British director Ken Loach.
Ah, yes.
And he's got a film called I, Daniel Blake, which I think squarely puts you in the life of a man who's confronting unemployment and how he has to deal with it. It sounds pretty grim, but a good friend of mine who has seen it at the film festival said it was absolutely amazing. So if I can steel myself, Steve, I might go see that and chat about it next time, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, we've also got coming up very, very shortly Nocturnal Animals, which does look a little bit special. Quick synopsis. An art gallery owner is haunted by her ex-husband's novel, a violent thriller she interprets as a veiled threat. Now, that was being previewed in about a week's time. It should be coming out in New Zealand in about 2 weeks. Now, this has got Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal or Gyllenhaal? How do we choose to pronounce this one?
I think it's Gyllenhaal, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's got Jake in it.
It's got Jake, yep.
It's got Jake. Definitely got Jake in it. It's also got Isla Fisher, Armie Hammer, Laura Linney, Andrea Riseborough. I mean, there's a top. Michael Sheen's in it. This is a monster cast.
Yes. Oh, also, Amy Adams is in the aforementioned Arrival as well. She's the lead, I think.
She's getting around a bit lately.
Yeah. Oh, well, there's lots to talk about. Excellent. I think we should wrap this little, what's the expression? This little puppy up. It's not a puppy, but.
No. It's like an overly affectionate and fully grown golden retriever, really, isn't it?
It is. At lapping at our feet as we speak.
Oh, dear Lord. We're flogging this one to death now, aren't we? It's not going to end well.
Oh, let's get out of here. Hey, this has been Crave. You'll be pleased to hear. We will be talking to you again about all sorts of matters to do with entertainment. You can get in touch with us. We'd be very pleased to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, of course, or you can follow us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
All well and good. So, I'm Simon Merced.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding.